Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a story and issue in the news that looms large following today's ruling by the Supreme Court to strike down the key provision in the Voting Rights Act that protects young, elderly and minority voters in 15 states from an array of new and improved Jim Crow laws and voting suppression devices that make it harder for those likely to vote for Democratic candidates. Elizabeth Wydra, Chief Counsel of the Constitutional Accountability Center, who was in the Supreme Court today, joins us to discuss this radical ruling. Then we'll examine the implications of this ruling on voting rights and election protection with Wendy Weiser, who directs the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU Law School, where she founded and directs the center's Voting Rights and Election Project. We will discuss what remedies are likely to come from a gridlocked and dysfunctional Congress and whether it will be open season from now on in those states with a recent history of trying to enact voter suppression laws that were stopped by the Voting Rights Act, given that they are now free to enact a whole range of voting restrictions claiming to prevent the negligible, if not non-existent, problem of voter fraud. Then finally, we will speak with Azeez Haque, who was a clerk at the Supreme Court for Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who issued a strong and almost indignant dissent, which she read aloud, pointing out the lack of logic and legal underpinning of the conservative majority's opinion that praised the effectiveness of the Voting Rights Act before gutting the very mechanism that makes it work, while declaring it unconstitutional without bothering to cite what part of the Constitution it violated. And joining us now is Elizabeth Wydra, who's the Chief Counsel of the Constitutional Accountability Center, a think tank law firm and action center dedicated to showing how the text and history of the Constitution support progressive outcomes. She frequently participates in Supreme Court litigation and has argued several important cases in the Federal Court of Appeals. Welcome to Background Briefing, Elizabeth Wydra.
Thank you. It's great to be here with you.
And you were in the Supreme Court today when the decision came down to void Section 4 of the Voting Rights Act, which effectively nullifies the important Section 5, which requires mostly southern states with a history of discrimination to have preclearance from the federal government if they want to change their voting laws. And as recently as in this last election cycle, both Texas and South Carolina tried to make it more difficult for minorities to vote, and the federal government intervened under Section 5. So what was the sense? Because it was a very, I thought, very passionate and well-argued dissent from Justice Ginsburg. But since you were there, what was the body language, if you will, of the same five justices who ruled on Citizens United?
Well, I think that Justice Alito might have gotten a talking to from Chief Justice Roberts after he rolled his eyes and shook his head while Justice Ginsburg was reading her dissent in some employment discrimination cases yesterday, because the body language was certainly not as notable as yesterday. But you're right, Justice Ginsburg gave a very well-reasoned dissent that focused on how the text and history of the Constitution support what Congress did when it reenacted the Voting Rights Act and this all-important preclearance provision. And not only that, but she also cited all of the evidence that shows that this preclearance provision continues to be the most important shield of protection that Americans have to ensure that their right to vote is not burdened by racial discrimination.
Well, the odd thing about this ruling is that Justice Roberts, in his opinion, wrote that there is no doubt that these improvements are in large part because of the Voting Rights Act. The Act has proved immensely successful at redressing racial discrimination and integrating the voting process. So on the one hand, he says this is the reason this has worked, but then he turns around and him and his four conservative colleagues turn around and take away the reasons why it's worked. I mean, it's a peculiar ruling.
It's so successful. Now let's gut it. it's very, I think, disheartening. Congressman Lewis, who nearly died trying to get the Voting Rights Act passed in 1965, said that the majority's opinion put a dagger through the heart of the Voting Rights Act, and I totally agree. You know, it's very odd that the majority of the court relied so much on progress that our country has made in preventing racial discrimination in voting, when that progress is in large part due to the success of the preclearance provision. And to take that away really just doesn't make any sense from a policy standpoint, and certainly is not supported by the Constitution, which puts the decision on how best to protect the right to vote squarely in the hands of Congress. It says in the 15th Amendment, Congress shall enforce the protections that are in that amendment and in the other amendments that protect the right to vote. The Supreme Court today basically second-guessed Congress and disregarded the more than 10,000 pages of record that Congress amassed when it decided to reauthorize the preclearance provision of the Voting Rights Act in 2006.
So when the Chief Justice Roberts says that the 40-year-old formula that the Voting Rights Act is operated under is based on obsolete statistics and that the coverage formula violates the Constitution, that's the opposite of what you're saying, that this ruling violates the Constitution. Did Roberts elaborate on what part of the Constitution the Section 4 and 5 of the Voting Rights Act violated?
No, and, you know, I think that it is incredibly important for everyone to understand that. Chief Justice Roberts never identifies the provision of the Constitution that the coverage formula, that Section 4 of the Voting Rights Act, violates. Even though he is striking down a part of a congressional enactment, he never identifies what part of the Constitution it violates. You know, he says that that the Voting Rights Act is inconsistent with the letter and spirit of the Constitution, but his opinion is all spirit. You know, conservatives like to mock decisions that rely on emanations and penumbras, but you know, that's what's going on in his opinion today. And I think it's very important to note that, you know, he says this is outdated, but as Justice Ginsburg listed in her dissent, we have numerous examples of changes to voting laws that were blocked in the years leading up to the 2006 reauthorization of the Voting Rights Act because of preclearance. These aren't, 40-year-old problems. These are problems that were going on in the 90s, in 2000s, and as we saw in the last election, continue to be a problem with states trying to suppress the African-American vote and being, we've had FBI investigations catch state legislators on record admitting that they're trying to specifically suppress the African-American votes.
Again, I'm speaking with Elizabeth Wider, who's the chief counsel of the Constitutional Accountability Center, a think tank, law firm, and action center dedicated to showing how the text and history of the Constitution support progressive outcomes. She frequently participates in Supreme Court litigation and has argued several important cases in the Federal Court of Appeals and was in the Supreme Court today when this, what seems to be a radical ruling, came down in voiding Section 4 of the Voting Rights Act, and in doing so, making Section 5, the important section, pretty much moot. I mean, since it appears to be, again, you just said that in effect that this is a form of judicial activism, the very thing that conservative judges accuse liberal judges of doing, of violating the original intent. I mean, isn't the 15th Amendment, isn't that a part of original intent?
Absolutely. And if you look at the original meaning of the 15th Amendment, and in particular, the enforcement clause of the 15th Amendment, which specifically gives Congress the authority to enforce the right to vote free from discrimination, that is, free from racial discrimination, that is promised in the 15th Amendment. The drafters of that amendment specifically wanted Congress to be able to be the one to decide how best to protect the right to vote, because, you know, it's not surprising. The 15th Amendment was passed in the wake of the Civil War, just a few years after the Supreme Court said in Dred Scott that an African-American man had no rights that the white man was bound to respect. So you can see how the drafters of the 15th Amendment wanted the Supreme Court to defer to Congress on these issues. And you know, perhaps more practically, Congress is in a much better position to engage in the fact-finding that supports complicated legislative provisions like the coverage formula of the Voting Rights Act. And Congress did its job in 2006 when it was considering the reauthorization of the Voting Rights Act by amassing a huge record that showed that the coverage formula continues to be accurate and responsive to the continued problem of racial discrimination in voting.
And they extended it for 25 years, and President George W. Bush signed it into law. And I believe, wasn't there a substantial majority in both the Senate and the House? In fact, almost a unanimous majority in the Congress?
Exactly. You know, we had 98 senators vote to reauthorize the coverage formula, reauthorize the Voting Rights Act. And, you know, we have bipartisan majorities in Congress voting to reauthorize it with this coverage formula. And we had, as you mentioned, George W. Bush sign it into law. And now, unfortunately, we know that when Chief Justice Roberts says, oh, okay, Congress, go back to the drawing board on the coverage formula, we know that that's just going to result in gridlock in Congress, although I certainly hope that we again might see bipartisan majority come together to protect the right to vote. But, you know, we've seen what's been going on with Congress. And in the meantime, it means that the American people are left without this incredibly important protective measure that ensures that all Americans can enjoy the constitutional promise of free and fair access to the ballot box.
So if this decision had come down before the last election, and in the last election we know that in a lot of the states covered by the Voting Rights Act, and particularly Florida, for example, African Americans had to wait for hours and hours in line. There were just obviously deliberate obstacles thrown in their paths by Republican governors and Republican legislators in these states. It's just indisputable. So just a theoretical question. Had this law been struck down before that last election, is it possible that Romney could have won?
You know, I mean, it's certainly possible that minority voters could have been disenfranchised. You know, I don't know exactly how that breaks down in terms of the presidential vote, but, you know, I mean, you can draw that conclusion. And it's even with today's ruling, Texas has already said that they're going to implement their redistricting plan that a federal court using the Voting Rights Act preclearance provision said they were going to block because it negatively affected African American and Latino voters. So we already have seen that states that have been prevented from putting into effect these laws that could disenfranchise American voters on the basis of race could now go into effect.
Well, it just feels like these five conservative or right-wing justices in the Citizens United decision, they simply departed from precedent, from a system that was, you know, hardly working, but it wasn't completely broken, and they just absolutely eviscerated it and made a free-for-all with money. And there's no question, there is simply no question that subsequent to their decision on Citizens United, enormous amounts of money have poured into our political system, and most of it has come from anonymous donors supporting right-wing and Republican candidates. It's just a fact. All of that work that Karl Rove did, the anonymity that these 501c4 vehicles provided them with, was a huge advantage, not to say that Democrats didn't try to play catch-up. But you just start to see whether the five justices are acting out of pure partisanship. That's a question that you can certainly raise, but the results clearly show partisan advantage to conservative right-wing politics. There's just no escaping the fact that this ruling is going to help the Republicans and hurt the Democrats.
Well, I think the most important thing from my perspective is that it's likely to hurt American voters. And, you know, we all have the right, regardless of the color of our skin, to cast a vote, to be equal citizens, and have the full and meaningful political participation. And I am worried that this decision will negatively impact Americans' rights to the meaningful citizenship that the Constitution guarantees to us all, that unfortunately a majority of conservative justices on the Supreme Court today disregarded.
Well, but I'm just trying to get my head around this, Elizabeth Wydra, that the Chief Justice ruled basically saying, you know, the Voting Rights Act has worked, and now that it's worked, we're going to take away the reason why it worked. And our argument basically rests on the idea that this 40-year-old formula has worked, but we've decided it's unconstitutional, even though we won't afford you, the American people, the reasons why we've decided it's unconstitutional, and even cite the part of the Constitution that it's violated. You just get the feeling that these guys are just doing what they want to do, and the legal reasoning comes later, if it comes at all.
Yeah, and that's really important, because what the court has done today is they've second-guessed Congress, which the Constitution, that's not what the Constitution suggests is the court's job when it comes to protecting the right to vote. And I think it's important to recognize that, you know, Chief Justice Roberts likes to say in his ruling that, you know, the South has changed. He pointed out that there are problems in other parts of the country that aren't covered by the formula. But, you know, the statute itself allows for, you know, hey, if the South has changed, if states in the South have changed, the statute allows for them to bail out of the coverage formula. If they don't have a recent history of discrimination in voting, they can bail out of that coverage formula and not be subject to it anymore. But it's very telling that Shelby County, Alabama, which brought this lawsuit in the first place, can't take advantage of that part of the statute, because they do have a recent history of voting discrimination. And so, you know, Chief Justice Roberts ignores that, but Congress put into the statute, you know, it's not 40 years out of date. If the South has changed sufficiently, as he kept saying, then those jurisdictions should be able to bail out. And if there are other parts of the country that have become so bad when it comes to racial discrimination in voting, the statute has a bail-in mechanism. So the statute, you know, Congress actually did a really good job with it and made it sufficiently flexible to be consistent with the times. And it is really just, frankly, heartbreaking that such an incredibly effective statutory provision of the Voting Rights Act has basically been dealt a fatal blow by a conservative majority on the Supreme Court, simply because it's been incredibly effective.
But just in closing, though, Elizabeth Wydra, they are completely ignoring the evidence that's so manifest that just in the last cycle, there were attempts at sort of reviving Jim Crow kinds of laws, voter IDs, which are expensive and then could fall under the idea of a poll tax, which it ruled against, I believe, in Georgia. Then you had the South Carolina case. And just look what's just happened in North Carolina. They're passing laws like crazy because the Republicans, an extremely conservative group of Republicans, control the entire state. And there's nothing to stop them except time and demographics, and they're moving with lightning speed. They're even passing laws, for example, that say that students cannot vote in their, you know, states and areas where they're attending college. They have to return home to vote. A clear attempt. In fact, they tried that in Texas to disenfranchise young people and particularly young minorities. It's just obvious what they're doing. They've been doing it, and now that the coast is clear for them, they're going to do a lot more of it.
Well, I think that's an important point, because as Justice Ginsburg noted in her dissent, what you're describing are sort of the sort of more subtle second generation barriers to voting that are used to suppress votes of minorities. And, you know, the court today wanted to say, oh, look, the particular tests and devices that were used in 1965 to suppress minority votes, those have been eradicated. So we don't need this particular coverage formula in the Voting Rights Act anymore. But as you note, it's very important to recognize that we have still today laws being passed that in the covered jurisdictions that are basically attempted substitutes for these first-generation barriers that originally triggered the preclearance provision in the first place.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Elizabeth Wydra.
It's my pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Elizabeth Wydra, who's the Chief Counsel of the Constitutional Accountability Center, a think tank, law firm, and action center dedicated to showing how the text and history of the Constitution support progressive outcomes. She frequently participates in Supreme Court litigation and has argued several important cases in the Federal Court of Appeals. She was also at the Supreme Court today when this tectonic ruling took place. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with a voting rights and election protection specialist.
In a little tent, oh, and just like the river I've been running ever since. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Wendy Weiser, who directs the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU School of Law, where she founded and directs the center's Voting Rights and Elections Project, which has protected the voting rights of hundreds of thousands of citizens in recent years. She's authored a number of nationally recognized publications and articles on voting rights and election reform, litigated groundbreaking voting rights lawsuits, testified before both houses of Congress and in a variety of state legislatures, and provided policy and legislative drafting assistance to federal and state legislators and administrators across the country. Welcome to Background Briefing, Wendy Weiser.
Thank you.
And this extraordinary ruling that came from the Supreme Court today, I'm still trying to get my head around it, because the Chief Justice Roberts praised the Voting Rights Act, said it had really worked, and then proceeded to take away the very mechanism why it worked, at the same time saying this mechanism was unconstitutional without citing what part of the Constitution it violated.
Yeah, it is a shocking decision. I'm still having trouble getting over the shock of a five-justice slim majority sweeping away what has been the most effective protection in American law against voting discrimination, the crowning achievement of the civil rights movement. It is a shocking and sad day in American democracy.
And do you think that the full weight of it will be understood? I mean, the whole purpose of the Voting Rights Act, at least in part, it seemed to me that it was naming and shaming those states that did terrible things. And there's a history, of course, of hundreds of years since the slaves were freed, where they were put back in bondage by Jim Crow laws, and their citizenship was denied and delayed in spite of the 14th Amendment. And then the 15th Amendment basically is the foundation that we're talking about here. And it seems to me that the conservative majority is violating the 15th Amendment with this ruling.
Yeah, let me explain a little bit of what is lost in this ruling. The court actually acknowledged that voting discrimination is still a problem today, and it acknowledged that Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, the real heart of that crowning landmark law, has been effective in blocking voting discrimination and in bringing about huge progress in political equality in our country. So it acknowledged those things, and it didn't even say that Section 5 is unconstitutional. What it said is another section of the law, the section that named which states are subject to the protections of Section 5, was unconstitutional. So while it purported to uphold that core provision of the Voting Rights Act, it has been rendered inoperative by saying that nobody right now is constitutionally it's not subject to that requirement.
But they didn't cite what part of the Constitution it was violating. I mean, under the 15th Amendment, isn't it the Congress's right and duty to set laws?
Yeah, Absolutely. The 15th Amendment expressly gives Congress the authority to pass laws to protect against voting discrimination, to bring about equality in the voting system. That is a direct and express grant of power to Congress. Congress is the central player in that. Certainly the court has a role in protecting against voting discrimination and promoting equality under both the 14th and 15th Amendments, but Congress has been really given paramount authority. And while on the one hand the court recognized that Congress has that authority and can constitutionally act in this realm, and that is a relief, it didn't respect that authority. And it just swept away what Congress did. Congress found by overwhelming bipartisan majorities that the states that it had targeted under the Voting Rights Act were the states where there was the worst problem of discrimination and that were justified special provisions, special protections that they get their voting changes looked at and approved by the federal government to make sure that they're not discriminatory before they go into effect. That's what Congress found. It was a near unanimous majorities in both houses of Congress. And the court just swept that away, saying, "Hey, the formula you used was based on outdated, old data." The court didn't even say that the states were the wrong states; that those states didn't have a bigger voting discrimination problems presently. The court was just concerned that Congress was using an outdated formula to arrive at which states those would be.
Again, I'm speaking with Wendy Weiser, who directs the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU School of Law, where she founded and directs the center's Voting Rights and Elections Project, which has protected the voting rights of hundreds of thousands of citizens in recent years. And as you pointed out, it was only recently renewed for 25 years, the Voting Rights Act, signed into law by President George W. Bush. I think 98 out of 100 senators voted for it, and then there was an equal and similar majority in the House, an overwhelming majority. So the Congress has spoken. Now, if it's kicked back to this dysfunctional and gridlock Congress, good luck at getting anything changed. I mean, it feels to me like a very cynical ruling where the conservative justices, just as they did in Citizens United, completely radically changed things and damn the consequences. They're not even telling us what the legal underpinning of their decision is, and they're telling us that something has worked, but now we don't need it to work anymore because it's worked. When we know that in the last election cycle, there was a myriad of attempts to suppress voting. And presumably from now on, every one of these voting suppression tricks that have gone on, particularly in the southern states, will go on in spades, surely.
I fear that we're going to see a huge spate of discriminatory voting activity in the states that were previously covered. There is a host of laws and other voting changes that were just recently blocked by Section 5, ones that were recently deterred by Section 5, ones that are waiting in the wings that are now all going to be thrown into question. In Texas, for example, where a three-judge court in D.C. found its voter ID law was actually discriminatory and couldn't be implemented, just announced today, before the ink was even dry on the decision that it was putting in place its voter ID law, the one that was found to be discriminatory. We expect that lots of other settled disputes are going to be thrown into question again. There are going to be battles in states across the country.
So can we just go through a little bit of this for our audience just to get their heads around how radical this ruling is? It's denying, in effect, that we have a problem when we know from the last election we have a problem. We know that thousands and thousands of African Americans, for example, in Florida stood in lines for 6, 8, 10 hours to vote, determined to exercise their rights. We know that Texas tried to pass voter ID laws that in many ways were smacked of Jim Crow and poll tax. We know that South Carolina tried. We know that now in the legislature in North Carolina, they're passing all kinds of voting restrictions that are just breathtaking in their scope. Can you just sketch out some of this and who the states are, just for us to understand? Because the Citizens United decision basically has changed the entire electoral landscape. Money is just poured in indiscriminately and unchecked and unattributed into our politics. They've changed it radically. I'm suggesting here, which I think is fairly logical, that this ruling is going to have an equally radical effect on our elections, because we know what they've been trying to do, and now the very mechanism that was preventing them from doing what they were trying to do is out. So what's to stop them?
We have certainly lost our, you know, most potent tool to fight against discrimination in voting today, and that is a significant loss. And it is happening at a time when it is badly needed, when there was a huge evidence of ongoing voting discrimination in the states. And as you mentioned, there are efforts to pass large-scale laws that make it harder for Americans to vote in lots of states that have been covered by the Voting Rights Act. Section 5 has been a tool to mitigate or block some of those laws. But even more broadly, Section 5 operates every single day in town elections, municipal elections, county elections, school board elections, state elections in covered jurisdictions across the country. And that's where, we're going to see real sweeping impacts. I mean, there are, have been recent efforts to shut out minority candidates from municipal office holding, from school board elections. There have been efforts to shut down polling places in minority neighborhoods in jurisdictions across the country. These kinds of slippery changes that pop up and affect one election at a time are going to be really hard to target and fight back against without Section 5.
And how many states are there? I understand that in total there were 26 states, but is it, 15 that have basically been the most egregious and the ones that have to be pre-cleared? I'm just not sure of the figures.
There are 9 states that were before today covered in their entirety by Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. There were parts of 6 other states, counties or townships in 6 other states that also had to get their voting changes pre-cleared, checked for discriminatory laws. So that it's at 9 plus parts of 6 more.
That's 15, right?
And those are really, have been the worst offenders. And there's nothing in the court's decision that challenges Congress's determination there. There's no those are the worst offenders and the places where problems of voting discrimination have been the worst. And now in all of those states, the millions of Americans won't have those kinds of protections, the most powerful protections we have against voting discrimination. They are not the only protections we have in American law, but it has been the most effective and necessary protection that we have had until today.
So if the Supreme Court, the same majority that ruled on Citizens United, is immune from, are they immune from understanding the results of what they've done in that? And would they therefore be immune from what the results will be from this decision today? Particularly when the Chief Justice says, it's really worked. We've gotten rid of discrimination over the years. And then he turns around to take away the very mechanism that's made it work. So let's not say that the guy is a hypocrite or that he's totally partisan, that he just wants to get rid of the Democratic Party and have Republicans in perpetual rule in this country, which certainly has helped the Citizens United decisions help them in that regard. So assuming that he's not completely cynical, is it possible that given the logical consequences of this ruling that the evidence will be out there fairly soon for all to see? And does it matter to these people? Does it matter what's happened with Citizens United and will happen with this voting rights decision?
It is not clear to me how affected this Supreme Court majority is to public opinion. I mean, Citizen United has been one of the most unpopular court decisions in history. Americans have been outraged by it. I suspect that this decision in the Shelby County case will rise to similar levels. That is the bad news. The good news is that as a formal matter, the decision was actually quite narrow. In its impact, it was extraordinarily expansive. It has essentially rendered this core provision of the Voting Rights Act inoperative across the country. But as a formal matter, it acknowledged that voting discrimination still exists. It acknowledged that Congress is still the body that has the power to fix that. It acknowledged that Section 5, the critical mechanism, is still permissible and still good law. And what it narrowly did is just struck down the list of states that Congress found it applies Section 5 to, and it punted it back to Congress. So the silver lining is there's something we can do about it. We can call on Congress to immediately restore that core provision of American law, to restore the Voting Rights Act. Congress can, it said it just needs to pass a law using updated criteria. So if Congress updates the criteria, we can get that back in place. I understand that there are a lot of challenges in Congress, but I like to believe that the Voting Rights Act is different. It is special. That Americans, we've all grown up with the understanding of the Voting Rights Act as a critical crowning achievement of the civil rights movement, as a core protection in American law, something that we take for granted, the realization of the values of the Declaration of Independence, that we're all created equal. It has such an iconic status in American law and culture, and the problem of voting discrimination is still so pervasive that I would like to believe that, we are not going to be able to stand letting it go, and that we're going to call on Congress to step in immediately to put it back in place.
But surely this is an invitation to the kind of cynicism that we've heard from these Southern Republican governors and senators. Just today, in response to this ruling, Senator Johnny Isaacson, a Republican of Georgia, said, "I'm very proud of what the South has done. The modernization, that's the key word, of our voting rights laws. Voting rights must be protected, but it's time for Congress to review the criteria." I mean, everything that they do in terms of voter suppression is in the name of modernizing, of making, getting rid of fraud, even though there's been no evidence presented that fraud is almost negligible, if not non-existent. That is the rubric. It's all about we need voter IDs, we need to modernize, we need to update. That's the way that the discrimination takes place. This is the modern face of Jim Crow. It's not as crude as it used to be. It's much more subtle, and they're basically saying, we got these outdated laws, and let's just, update them and make it all modern. But you know what the consequences are. I don't mean to be too upset here, but
a modern American law would still have strong protections against voting discrimination. That is a core and foundational principle on which our democracy rests. And so it is all fine and good to modernize our voting system. We are for that. There are lots of great things we can do. Getting rid of our foundational protections against voting discrimination is not modernization. And if you're taking Georgia, for example, they, can't claim that this is an outdated protection. There have been a number of voting changes that were blocked in recent years. And in fact, this past year alone, a whole bunch of changes that as discriminatory. It is not out of date in Georgia or in, most of the other jurisdictions that have been covered. And the law itself dealt with that issue. If a state actually had a clean bill of health, if it became outdated, if the state no longer had a problem of voting discrimination under the law, it could bail out of coverage of the Voting Rights Act. It can apply once it's had 10 years without voting discrimination to be removed from coverage of the law. So it becomes obsolete on its own terms. It did not require the Supreme Court to throw it out if it was, if a state truly no longer had a problem with voting.
Right, and a number of states have already bailed out.
there's been a huge number of states and other localities that have bailed out that have shown, yes, we have, in fact, gotten past voting discrimination in our jurisdiction. And those states aren't covered. It's the states that still have persistent problems of voting discrimination, that still are outside of the norm, that have this protection in place. You know, and Congress, by overwhelming majorities, agreed that that needed to happen. And I understand that there are some members of Congress today who come from some of those states that you know, might have a different view. But nonetheless, it is still the case that most Americans and most members of Congress know that this is still a problem and something that we need to address.
Well, Wendy Weiser, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Wendy Weiser, who directs the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU School of Law, where she founded and directs the center's Voting Rights and Elections Project, which has protected the voting rights of hundreds of thousands of citizens in recent years. And she has authored a number of nationally recognized publications and articles on voting rights and election reform, litigated groundbreaking voting rights lawsuits, and testified before both houses of Congress. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with Aziz Haque, professor of law at the University of Chicago, a former clerk at the Supreme Court, for Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
Too many martyrs and too many deaths, too many lives. Too many empty words were said, too many times for too many angry men. Oh, let it never be again. Then the boy became a man, the man became a cause, the cause became the hope for the country and its laws. They tried to burn his home.
Don't need to change, the future's ours. You don't need to change.
Oh, if I still go, if I still go.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Aziz Haque, a professor of law at the University of Chicago. He's a former clerk for Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg at the Supreme Court and is the co-author of Unchecked and Unbalanced: Presidential Power in a Time of Terror. Welcome to Background Briefing, Aziz Haque.
Thank you for having me, Ian.
And Ruth Bader Ginsburg read her dissent. It was both passionate and, I think, indignant. And it was a pretty extraordinary ruling today where the Chief Justice praised the Voting Rights Act and its success and then went ahead to gut the very mechanism that made it work, and even declaring that mechanism unconstitutional without citing why it was unconstitutional and what part of the Constitution it violated. I mean, I'm completely puzzled.
I think that Justice Ginsburg's best line, and the one that most neatly encapsulates this decision, is that the Supreme Court today justified throwing away its umbrella in the middle of a rainstorm on the ground that it had that umbrella had kept it dry until now. Striking down Section 4 of the Voting Rights Act, which is one of the key mechanisms in that 1965 statute, is effectively what the Supreme Court has done. It's opened the gates to what we should expect to see, a flood of discriminatory and disenfranchising practices being installed in jurisdictions that used to be covered by that statute.
And the Chief Justice, he even talked about the Freedom Summer of 1964 and mentioned the towns where the civil rights workers were murdered, and then went on to say, today, both of those towns are governed by African-American mayors. Problems remain in these states and others, but there is no denying that due to the Voting Rights Act, our nation has made great strides. Now, again, it's surreal in the context of what he's done, because we know from the very last election there was an enormous number of efforts at election suppression and tricks and devices to suppress the votes of those who are likely to vote Democrat, and particularly in Texas and South Carolina, etc. So now that that barrier is removed, it's logical to expect that. But what I was impressed by in her dissent from the bench, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg turned it around on Roberts by invoking Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, saying, "The great man who led the march from Selma to Montgomery and their call for the passage of the Voting Rights Act foresaw progress even in Alabama," she said. "The arc of the moral universe is long," he said, "but it bends towards justice. If there is a steadfast commitment to see the task through to completion, that commitment," she said, "has been disturbed by today's decision." So in terms of the power of rhetoric and using icons and alluding to the Civil War, there's no question that Ruth Bader Ginsburg won the argument. But the fact remains, Aziz Huck, that the law of the land has been passed in this very negative direction.
And I think one way of thinking or reflecting upon what happened today is by noticing not just the way that, as you say, the Chief Justice strives to inoculate himself from the accusation of either racial animus or racial insensitivity by recognizing the past. Not just looking at that, but looking at what he places on the other side of the scale, right? What is it that's outweighing the need to remedy racial discrimination at the polls, something that, seemingly everybody recognizes as being a great harm? The thing that's on the other side of the scale for the Chief Justice is the equal sovereignty of the state. And two things about that. The first thing is that the decision is remarkable in that it describes state sovereignty in terms of the states as they existed at the time of the Constitution's founding, at the time that something called the 10th Amendment was enacted in 1791. The 10th Amendment is thought by some to reflect a principle of state sovereignty, and essentially ignores the fact that after the Civil War, a series of amendments, including the 14th and 15th Amendment, which are the foundation of Congress's authority to enact the Voting Rights Act, a series of amendments were passed called the Reconstruction Amendments, precisely to curtail state sovereignty. So this is a ruling that on its face seeks to unwind the balance of power between the federal government and the states to the state of the world pre-Civil War, pre those contractions of state sovereignty, which were seen to be necessary in order to protect racial equality, in order to vindicate, to achieve racial equality, which is, so it's quite the extraordinary ruling ties itself to the mast of 1789 and 1791 as a way of repudiating the legacy of the Civil War and the Reconstruction Amendment. So that's I think one way of thinking about it. The other thing to ponder is that the Chief Justice places a great deal of weight on what he calls the principle of equal sovereignty. All states have to be treated equally. And the Voting Rights Act, by singling out certain jurisdictions for more onerous scrutiny by the federal government, was infringing upon this principle of equal sovereignty. Well, where does this principle of equal sovereignty come from? How is the Senate, which formally treats states equally, but weighs the population of California very differently from the population of Wyoming? How is that equality for the people who live in those states? By contrast, how is the House of Representatives, if you think that all states have to be equal? Well, how do you reconcile that with the fact that all states have different voting strengths in the House of Representatives? How do you reconcile the Chief Justice's principle of equal sovereignty of the states with any or all of the federal spending programs, from education to Medicaid to defense spending to roads, which treat states unequally by giving them unequal sums of money, unequal amounts of subsidy? Taken seriously, the principle on which today's opinion rests would require the invalidation of most forms of conditional federal spending to the states. And surely that's not going to happen. And I think that that's an indication that the scrim of language about state sovereignty, this sort of notional appeal back to 1791, ought not to be taken too seriously. Nor, I think, can the appeals to the tragic deaths of 1965, to the costs and burdens that were undertaken by the members of the civil rights movement, I think can we take those invocations as anything more on the part of the Chief Justice as an effort to head off at the pass what I think is fair accusations of at minimum insensitivity to the continued existence of racial bias at the polls.
Again, I'm speaking with Aziz Haque, who's a professor of law at the University of Chicago, and he's a former clerk for Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg at the Supreme Court, and is the co-author of Unchecked and Unbalanced Presidential Power in a Time of Terror. But the part that I find extraordinary, though, is that they said that the Section 4 was unconstitutional without citing what part of the Constitution it violated. And the truth of the matter is it was just renewed very recently, signed into law for another 25 years by President George W. Bush, with 98 out of 100 senators voting for it and an equal majority in the House. Now, if that's not the 15th Amendment at work, I don't know what is.
Well, the reason that the majority gave for invalidating the statute is that the provision at issue, Section 4, contains what's called a coverage formula. And the coverage formula determines which states are subject to what's called the preclearance requirement. And the preclearance requirement is in another part of the statute.
That's five, yeah.
And what the court said is, look, when in 2005 Congress reauthorized the Voting Rights Act, it didn't go back and recompile a body of evidence that required that demonstrated which states there was discrimination in. And so it was relying upon a record that was created in 1965, and that's irrational. Right. Implicitly, what the court is saying there, although it does not come out and say it, is that what Congress did was outside its authority under what are called the enforcement provisions of the 14th and 15th Amendments. These are provisions in the Reconstruction Amendments that vest Congress, and it was very deliberate on the part of the Reconstruction Congress, the drafters of those amendments, to say that it is Congress's role, not the courts, to determine what the appropriate remedy for structural racial injustice is. So this was the time in that courts were very conservative, were not at all trusted. In the last decade and a half, the court has developed a jurisprudence that puts the courts rather than Congress in the pilot seat, even with respect to the 14th and 15th Amendments. As I said, the Chief Justice, though, does not mention any of that. It's almost like he goes out of his way to elide the existence of Congress's authority under those amendments. He just doesn't, even though that's what's at issue, he doesn't mention the amendments. He doesn't mention them at length. He doesn't analyze at length the reasons why they were enacted, the allocation of authority to Congress rather than the courts. And he just says, look, this is irrational to rely upon this 1965 history in order when you reenact the statute in 2005. I think Justice Ginsburg's dissent gives very persuasive responses to that argument.
So when you said, Aziz Haq, that there was a period in our history when there was no respect for the law and that that's why the 15th and 14th Amendment gave the powers to the Congress, why should we respect these conservative justices anymore? I mean, the evidence has been pretty clear with Citizens United that that was a radical decision that's had enormous partisan advantage to Republicans and to the rich. Their recent rulings, for example, on the American Express case is completely pro-corporatist, as though they are the representatives of the 1%. And now they've come up with this ruling that they don't even bother to justify in logic and in law. What are we supposed to take from this? I mean, it's clearly open season now on voter suppression, particularly in these 15 states that are no longer covered by Section 5.
Well, I think there's two things to be said about that. The first thing is I think that the practical effect of this ruling depends upon whether either the Justice Department or private individuals are able to step up both activism and legal actions under, for example, Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, but also under other statutes, such as the National Voter Registration Act, which was at issue in another case that the Supreme Court decided this week, to compensate for the invalidation of Section 5. So I don't think that that compensation will be full bore. I think it will be partial. But I do think that it's not as if there will be nothing that flows into the absence of Section 5. The other, a second point there to note is that during the 1980s and early 90s, a Republican Justice Department used Section 5 as a way of pushing particularly African-American voters, concentrating them in single districts where they would be, you know, super majorities of the electorate rather than dispersing them among several districts. And this had the effect within a state of, on the one hand, guaranteeing, say, one African-American representative in a congressional delegation, but on the other hand, guaranteeing seven Republican state seats. So there was at least under some iterations of Voting Rights Act jurisprudence, the statute has had quite ambivalent effects, and so there is a little bit of an upside there with respect to fairness in elections. I don't want to make too much of that, but that is I think part of the historical background to bear in mind. So, you know, I think that this is very, what's happened is absolutely serious, and organizations like the Brennan Center, where I used to work, have compiled persuasive empirical evidence of what sort of...
Right. People should go to their website, by the way, and look at that, because it's all catalogued and documented there. I'm afraid we've run out of time, Aziz Haq, but I thank you very much for joining us.
No, thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Aziz Haq, professor of law at the University of Chicago. He's a former clerk for Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg at the Supreme Court and is the co-author of Unchecked and Unbalanced: Presidential Power in a Time of Terror. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Claire Goldsmith. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Bye.